Hey guys, welcome back to the Staying Christian podcast. Today we have an interview for you. We interviewed our good friend Simca Sandra Wiesar. She goes by Simca or Sandra sometimes.
Right, yeah.
That's why I said it that way. It's like also known as.
Yeah.
Anyway, we brought her on. We had a really good time talking about her life story and her becoming a Christian.
Yeah, it was really amazing. Like, I was blown away with the story. Like, I've never actually sat down with her before and just been like, what's your life story? And like, this time it was like, oh my gosh, this is pretty wild.
Right. It probably helps for us to have known her a little more.
Right.
But anyway,
she's an amazing, amazing person. There's some absolutely redonkulous stories in this episode,
right,
as per usual. With all of our interviews, we have these crazy stories that like I never saw coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway, we hope you enjoy it, and we'll just put you right in.
Yeah, here we go.
I was wondering, and yeah, I'm sure Gavin was also wondering, how'd you become a Christian?
Oh, that is such a long story. Let me see if I can give you the Reader's
Digest.
Well,
that's what we're here for.
When I was growing up, my mother was very, very ill.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got older, it just became, our home life was extremely chaotic. Everything about our home life was just utter chaos. Several times in a week, we'd end up calling an ambulance to come to our house.
Mm-hmm.
A very repeated event. Got to the point, by the time I was the end of middle school, roughly, maybe junior high, right in there, it just got to the point where we call the ambulance comes to the house. My brother and I would go next door. And actually, I guess at that point, I was a little bit younger. Mm-hmm. So it had to be probably middle school and elementary. And every time that happened, which was two or three times a week, we'd kind of get the talk like,
yeah,
well, we're not really sure she's going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for years. So
what was going on with her? Why?
She had a very rare disorder called HHT.
Okay.
Which is, yep, the short version. That's a whole nother podcast all on its own.
Right.
They know so much more about it now, you know, than, mm-hmm, they did back then. Back then, it took them forever to diagnose her. She had rheumatic fever as a child, so that she had rheumatic heart disease, the HHT, and then had to have so many blood transfusions that she also got hepatitis.
Wow.
So,
wow,
they removed part of her lung. And one thing just always complicated the other thing. So, you know,
mm-hmm,
so
and I was traumatized, essentially.
Quick question.
Yeah.
So that's basically like your blood is super thin, something like that, right?
That's hemophilia.
That's okay.
In HHT, we are missing one of the chromosomes that actually make capillaries.
Okay.
Capillaries, mm-hmm, are what, when you get to the very end of the blood vessel, that's what passes the blood back and forth.
Right, from the main
right,
arteries to the veins. To get, yeah.
So, and the thing with HHT is it's pretty unpredictable. So with my mother, so a lot of your mucous membranes, the blood vessel just ends. So they can easily bleed.
You just have nosebleeds or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
So because it's mucous membranes, there's nosebleeds, there's the GI tract, there's your lungs, your brain.
Right. Oh, man. That's no good.
And it just kind of does whatever it wants.
Right.
So in our family, it seems like the majority of it is in our lungs.
Hmm.
But the stroke I had in 2015, I think it was.
Yeah.
Was from the HHT that I have.
Okay.
Because a blood vessel broke off in my lungs, even though I just had them all repaired. And they just told me, we won't need to see you for another 5 years.
Wow.
And 30 days later, I had that stroke. But, you know, again, God was just absolutely merciful. So that's how HHT works.
Okay.
But back then, they didn't know what they know now. They weren't doing anything preventative. So She bled internally all the time because her GI tract was just covered in, they call them telangiectasia, the ends of those blood vessels that burst.
Okay.
So she was always bleeding internally. She was kind of never not bleeding. If she had a nosebleed, it would, I mean, she'd bleed for an hour. And so it was just terrible. Mm. So they took out part of her lung, trying to fix it, the one that had, you know, most of the telangiectasias in there. So it was bad. Mm-hmm. You know, it was bad. And so all that being said, our family life was extremely traumatic. My dad was military, so he would leave for 6 months at a time. Mm-hmm. And
did you guys move a lot because he was military?
We actually didn't because she was so sick. Mm-hmm. We did in the very beginning. We used to live in the Keys. But once we got stationed, once he was stationed in Norfolk, Portsmouth, Virginia mm-hmm. Beach, there's so many places they can send him. He can be on a... You know, if he's on a tour where he has to go out to sea, they can just move him next door.
Right.
It's not like, so we didn't really have to move because of the medical hardship.
That's cool.
So
that's cool.
I went to all my schools there.
Oh, sweet. So you got to stay in one school basically your whole childhood?
Yeah. Well, I stayed almost in the same neighborhood my whole childhood. Yeah.
Okay. So at least one thing was sort of stable.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I lived in the same city the whole time. That was stable. So... as I got older, I think, I don't think it ever even occurred to my father that my brother and I might need some kind of help processing all this, you know, when you're told every day or several times a week for years, okay, your mom's not going to make it this time. Your mom's not going to make it this time.
Yeah.
You know, after a while you just start going, whatever, you know, you don't know what to do with that, you know? So I turned to drugs. Yeah. That's what I did. I don't even remember how I got introduced to them or the first time I did anything. It just, I think like everybody else who tries it, you try it, you don't like it, you think you're not going to do it again. But I had developed an innate, deep anger. I was just mad.
Yeah.
I was mad at the whole world. Angry at everybody, everything. I don't even think I realized how angry I was. Yeah. And that was what I did to cope for a long, long time. I ran away from home more times than I can count. Mm-hmm. Enough that finally, I guess I was 16, the cops who drove me home had driven me home so many times that they asked me one day, they said, we don't really know what's going on at your house, but would you want to be emancipated? And I was like, well, what's that?
Right.
And he's like, well, you would just become your own legal guardian. And I was like, yes, yes. Yeah. That's what I've been trying to do for all this time. And they said, okay, wait in the car. And they went and talked to my dad. Hmm. And they talked him into it. And I mean, I tortured my dad for the most part. I think because I was angry, there wasn't good communication. Mm-hmm. I was never bad enough to get thrown in jail, but I was bad enough to torture your parents.
Yeah.
And I think he was looking for a way to get me out. I know there was a couple times he wanted to put me in a girl's home, but I hadn't done anything wrong. So not as far as they were concerned. So he couldn't. So it was kind of a win-win for both of us at that point.
So that was at 16, you became your own legal guardian.
Yeah, 16, probably right before 17.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wow.
And what year, like around then?
So let me think here.
I'm asking because I think I heard somewhere that the emancipation like age to do that has been different.
It was in Virginia, so that was like in the 80s.
Okay.
Yeah, 79. Yeah, it would have been in the 80s.
Yeah.
So I was supposed to graduate from high school in 1982, but because of one of my runaway stints, I kind of went on Easter break and didn't go back. Mm-hmm. I had to do my junior year twice. So I ended up graduating in 1983. But my substance abuse just got really bad. Mm-hmm. And I was born and raised Catholic, but where we went to church, every event had a keg. So, you know, I'm not sure what I got out of all that.
Right.
Except I think something did get planted, because mm-hmm. when I got desperate, I would call on God.
Yeah.
And I know when I was younger, before everything seemed, before I realized how chaotic everything was, I mean, we were very faithful to go, you know, every week and in between and all that. And what I remember is all these little archway books, the stories of the Bible.
Yeah,
my parents never really reviewed those,
right.
But they always stood out to me, and how God would majorly intervene for people.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the way, I did the alcohol and the drugs for a long time. And one of the times before I was emancipated, let's see, how much of the story do I want to tell? Think about this for a minute. Long story short here, I had repeatedly probably pushed my parents to the edge, or terrified them completely about my behavior and whether I was going to live or not.
Oh,
So I was an underage cocktail waitress in the mall. Believe it or not.
In the mall?
How does that work? Like, in today's society, is that a still thing? A cocktail waitress in a mall?
Well, here's during the summers, I worked at a Italian place on the beach. Mm-hmm. Same owner opened a Greek restaurant in the mall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the only, I think at that particular time, it was the only restaurant that actually had a bar, but it was mostly restaurant. It was like two stories. So there's like this upper part with a bar, and then this whole big dining area.
Okay. So it's kind of hidden. Back up and up story.
Yeah, it was kind of wide open, really. But I guess I just worked for him for so long. I don't know if he, I just think he didn't care how old I was. So there were lots of times I came home inebriated. Mm-hmm. And this one particular time was just over the top. And my parents had already taken my house key away, pretty much said, if you don't come home when we tell you to come home, you know, we're just going to lock the door. And I had no key to get in. But my father also raised me to be, he wasn't a saint either growing up. And pretty much, I mean, I think rebellion just ran really strong mm-hmm. in our family, to be honest. And so I thought, we got a dog. If I ring the doorbell long enough, you'll let me in. I regretted that the next day. I didn't regret it at the moment that I did it. The next day, I think I came home. He was like, we have to take your mom to the hospital. And I, you know, put up a fight. I didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, I'll just go. And so we went like we were going to the hospital. But right outside the military gate where the hospital was, he pulled into this building. Well, and it was a rehab.
Yeah.
It was a rehab place. But I didn't know that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could think about at the time was, can we just hurry and get this over with? Mm-hmm. And plus, I was pretty hungover from the night before and not feeling that great.
Yeah.
And I finally figured out where we were. Now, mm-hmm. our family dynamic was complicated. There was... my dad and I could be close. He wasn't real good at communicating, but because my mom was always so sick, there was just kind of a dynamic there where I don't even know how to describe it, but he was the favorite parent for me in that particular case. I can look back on it now at my age and go, my mother wasn't trying to be terrible to me. She probably just, I didn't realize till I was much older, they had my mother on like 42 drugs at once, which I knew.
Wow.
But I always thought the majority, you know, that they were for fixing something on the inside. Now I review the names in my head and I'm like, this is an antidepressant. This is anti-anxiety. They all messed with their head. Right. So all the weird, crazy things she would do, I'm now going, she was drugged.
Yeah.
But I didn't think that at the time. I mean, she did crazy stuff. She wasn't just physically ill. She would make my brother leave his high school, pick me up at junior high school, take me home, and I would get accused of things like the crack that was in the ceiling. Mm-hmm. That was my fault. I did that. Wow. And she had to bring me home right then
to tell you,
to berate me for it.
Yeah. Wow.
And then my dad would go, no, you're not really going to get in trouble for that. But he would never back that up. So I genuinely did some things I certainly needed to be punished for. But there were so many unjust things that just fueled my anger. And it's like, are you going to back me up or not? You know, he'd say that he would, but then he wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Because I think he coped with it by working all the time. And see, I'm starting to, I've got to drink some water.
It's all good. Woo.
So you graduated, you made it.
I did graduate. I did make it. They did put me in rehab, but that was for me, a forever betrayal of trust. We had a knockdown drag out kind of in the parking lot.
Wow.
When I realized where we were, I remember blaming my mother like completely. He wouldn't do this to me. I remember this conversation. He wouldn't do this to me. You're doing this. You're making him do this, whatever. And essentially, my dad said, can we just walk in and see? And it's not like I really had a choice, you know. Mm-hmm.
Weren't you your own legal guardian at this point, or was this before?
No, this is before that.
Okay, so you truly didn't have a choice. Okay,
yeah, no, I really didn't have a choice. This was before that happened, or before I got emancipated.
Right.
I'm not telling you this in sequential order.
Okay, got it. Just making sure.
No, there's not a sequential bone in my body. You're not going to get it in sequential order.
No worries, no worries.
So, anyway, what I didn't know was once you walked in, you couldn't leave.
Really?
Because I was a minor, and what I have some real distinct memories of that place. Most of the people were older. I remember walking down the hall, and this kid my age walked by me and just whispered enough for me to hear. He said, no matter what happens, don't let them put you on the other side. I had no idea what that meant.
What?
I thought it was a code. I'm like, okay, I have no clue what he's talking about.
What's the other side?
Well, when they did all these tests on me, I had to answer a bunch of questions. I talked to a bunch of, I don't know what they were, counselors, psychiatrists, whatever. And then here's the part that was just intense, was they bring me back into this room with a closed door with all the people I had just talked to, all these white coat people. And my parents, and, you know, essentially just said, yeah, we feel like, you know, you abuse drugs and alcohol. You know, your substance abuse is beyond the limits. And we recommend that you do a volunteer 30-day rehab. And I'm like, well, that's easy. I don't volunteer.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we don't think you understand. And this went back and forth for a while. And I'm standing my ground. I'm like, no, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
Not doing it.
Right.
And they said, well, because you're a minor, you know, you don't really have a choice. And essentially, if you continue to put up a fight, we'll put you on the psychiatric ward on the other side. And I'm like, okay, I guess that was my line. That was my limit. So I volunteered, you know.
Instead of getting on the other side.
Instead of getting put in the psych ward.
Okay.
So I was like, oh, that's what he meant by that. But, you know, you can put somebody in there by force and change their behavior, but it didn't change anything inside of me.
Right.
I was dead set and determined. First thing I was going to do when I get out was
go get some booze,
or find a joint or something, you know, just because that's how I had learned to cope with my anger. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, right. I don't even know, you know, yeah, it was definitely for the escape, but I didn't know what to do with the injustice of it all. At least that's how I felt at the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can look back on it now and go, they probably didn't know what to do with me.
Right.
I was a piece of work, you know, and rightfully so. Honestly, I think one of the things I've had to do along the way with the Lord is not hate that person, that girl, you know, that I was. Yeah. Because I know at my age now, if I saw 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old child having to go through the experiences I went through, it makes me cry to think about it. I would have so much compassion for them, seeing it from the outside in. And so that's been a huge thing, I feel like, God has done for me, taking all that anger and harsh judgment and turning it into a way to be very compassionate with people. Especially young people. They're like my favorite, you know, because it's like, it's a tough time. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't care how good your family life is. Being young, it's, you couldn't pay me to be a teenager again for nothing.
Right.
I ain't doing it, you know, you know, I think all those circumstances, he's taught me life happens for you and not to you. Mm-hmm. And every one of those things he did for me and not to me. And
interesting. Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
I would not be who I am today if I did not have to live through those circumstances, you know? Mm. And I think it made me a better mother. I was kind of a hard mom, but I was the mom and the dad, but, and I would probably do a few things different, but the heart of what I was doing, I would do it again.
Yeah.
I would do it again. I wanted to raise emotionally resilient people who love God and know how to face a problem head on.
Yeah.
You know, be honest with yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Hold yourselves accountable or find someone who will help you.
Right.
Not listen to the excuses you make for yourself, you know. And I feel like I was successful at that only because of God and because I had a village of people supporting me. I couldn't have done that by myself.
Yeah.
But those circumstances, being raised in those circumstances, made a difference. Mm-hmm. They make a difference. They make you. Growth doesn't come from easy circumstances. You know, ease is not your friend.
And knock all that extra stuff off.
Yeah. Ease is not your friend. Comfort is not your friend, you know, and makes me think of that Much Afraid story, you know, where sorrow and suffering in the end, at the end of that book, they become peace and joy.
Right.
Because that's what makes or breaks a person.
Hmm.
But anyway, as far as God goes, so after, I had grown up a little bit there. I don't know how old I was. I can't, it's all kind of a blur to me now. In my journal, if I asked God once, I asked a million times to help me not do drugs and help me to not drink and all that. And, you know, inevitably not being able to fulfill that on my own.
Yeah.
And I remember this guy had asked me over for a date. He was a little higher classed of a gentleman than what I was normally accustomed to at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember going, okay, all the way there, I'm like having this conversation with God. And I have to say there was a long period of my life where I was reading the Bible, like devouring the Bible in my off times. I felt like two people because I was really hungry to know him.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to church. I didn't have a mentor. I don't even remember how I got this Bible, but I was really trying to figure out who God was. And it was the best Bible ever. It was one of those Thompson chain reference Bibles. Mm-hmm. So for me, not really knowing the Word of God that great, you could take a topic, you know, any topic, and from Genesis to Revelation, it would take you through every verse that has that word in it from beginning to end.
Right.
So you got a really awesome overview,
right,
of what he's saying.
Reference
with that
Bibles
word.
Are cool like that.
Yeah, they're super cool. I still love doing that, actually. Yeah. So I feel like I was still working nights at the time. So it was like I was one person during the day, just really trying to pursue him, and a complete and utter failure at night because of my habits, my association, mm-hmm, of who I was hanging around with.
Right.
And that went on for a while. He tolerated that for a long time. He was just gracious and merciful with, mm-hmm, me. And so I think I was still in that phase. And I do remember I was going to this guy's house for dinner, and I'm like, okay, no matter what happens, if he offers me a drink, I'm not going to take it. That's, mm-hmm, the battle of somebody who was so caught up in that without any distance in themselves. Right. And so all the way there, you know, I'm giving myself the pep talk and I'm asking God to do something and whatever. So I get there and, you know, first thing he does is offer me a drink. And I didn't feel like I could say no. He was, what did he offer? He like offered me champagne, which at that point in my life, champagne was such a higher classed offer of something to drink that I'm like, I feel rude or whatever, mm-hmm, saying no. So I was like, you know, I was like, sure. And I took the glass, mm-hmm, but I didn't drink out of it. Hmm. I took the glass, I put it on the table. He was going to do some grilling. He lived close to the beach. We were going to grill outside, kind of thing. So I remember going outside. God just did a miracle for me. And I will stick to this story. I don't care who believes it. I don't care who doesn't. So I remember walking out. We were going to play Frisbee with the dog, and he's going to put meat on the grill. And on the way down the steps, I took the glass and I just set it on the steps. So I took it with me, but I put it on the steps, so it was far away from me. And I was like, Lord, I don't know. I don't know if we knock it over with a Frisbee or whatever, but I'm just asking you to do something because my willpower was zilch. And, but I felt like I was trying to talk to God the whole time, you know, on the inside, right, in my innermost being. And I just remember we were outside, we were grilling, we were playing with the dog, whatever. And my attention stopped being focused on that. And we were only out there, I don't know, an hour, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes. I don't know. All I remember is going back up those steps. And when I went to pick up the glass, it was empty. There's no way the dog drank it. He didn't go up and down the steps, not one time. It was just empty. Mm-hmm. And I freaked out on the inside because I really was like, God answered me. Mm-hmm. I knew it. I just knew it.
Yeah.
So I like had to force myself to be normal through dinner. You know, I did, because inside I'm like, that was you. That was you, God. I know that was you. That was you. That was you. That's all I could think on the inside. So we went in, we had our dinner. It was easy for me to say no to the second offer. Right. And I just couldn't wait to get out of there. Right. And so
don't want to freak him out.
I didn't want to freak him out. I mean, I don't, you know.
So it wasn't even about him at that point. You're no. Like, so long, buddy. Something crazy just happened.
He was actually a really awesome guy. But, and we may have gone out again a couple more times after that. I don't remember. But I remember walking out of there, getting into my car, and driving down this very familiar stretch of road to my house, just freaking out. I mean, like sobbing and, mm-hmm, just going, he saw me.
Yeah.
You know? And he heard me. And I was just overwhelmed, you know, that he would do that for me. And it was pouring down rain, like worse than it is right now. And I remember I was crying so hard, I had to pull over to the side of the road. and just kind of get myself together. And I know John says, whether I was in the body or out of the body, remember when he talks about that?
Yeah.
You know, and all I know is that I felt like my spirit, when I pulled over on the side of the road, and I'm just thanking him, I'm just grateful, and I'm crying hysterically, and it just felt like my spirit left my body. And I just knew I was in the presence of the Lord. I mean, I couldn't see him with my eyes, but I knew what I knew. That's, I mean, you feel the awe. And just the majestic glory, you just sense it. And I felt like the Lord said to me, you are now born again, and you will never deny my name before any man as long as you live. And I remember I was born and raised Catholic. I'm not even sure I knew what born again was at that point. But I knew he was right. I knew he was right. And I remember driving home. I'm still freaking out. I was up all night journaling, waiting for the sun to come up because I wanted to tell somebody. And, you know, the only person I knew to try to tell was my dad. And at this point, I'm an adult. He's an adult. I'm kind of an adult. I'm a sub-adult.
Right.
And I called him, and, you know, and I should have known better than to call him. But, you know, he was my dad. And I remember calling him and just going, explaining what happened and that I got born again. And I'm just like a weirdo at this point. I'm freaking out still. And, you know, his comment to me was something like, we'll see how that, I guess time will tell, won't it? Or something like that. And I was like, yeah, I guess it will. You know? And that was the turning point for me. I mean, I still had a lot of struggles. I can't say I was completely clean after that. But my whole life definitely turned around for the most part. I did find a church. I did find new people to hang around with, you know, all that.
Wow.
So you just decided to start finding a church, or did
you, I think everything was incremental. I think it's like, what do I do now?
Right.
And it's hard for me to remember exactly what happened at that point, but I think I remembered a couple that when I was young and getting in a lot of trouble, they were the first born again Christians I'd ever met. Their daughter was in my class and they had just moved there. And, they would never let her come to my house. I've realized now as a parent how smart they were, but they would always, always let me go over there. And I think they saw my situation. I don't know that that even occurred to me at that stage of my life, but now I know they were trying to take good care of me. And so they were the only born again people I know. And I think I probably tried to reach out to them, and it was their church I ended up going to, and that kind of thing. And
okay, that's cool.
Yeah. So probably just one step at a time.
So like when you were reading the Bible a lot, what made you want to read before that whole miracle instance?
I think I've always wanted to know him.
Yeah.
I just do. I remember being a little like six, and I don't know if it was a grandparent. I don't think it was one of my grandparents, but somebody in the family who was Catholic on my mother's side. She's from Bogota, Colombia, so they're all Colombian. And but she had one sister that lived in Florida, and I think it was her, one of her husbands who had passed away. And all I know is I got this little card with even the Hail Mary prayer on it. Mm-hmm. And I made darn sure I used to sit there at night, 6 years old, and memorize it. Just memorize this prayer. So I guess I've always just wanted to know him.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he created that need.
Yeah, I think so,
you know,
too.
He went out of his way to create circumstances where I had a need and finally figured out, oh, I can't meet this need, and drugs and alcohol aren't going to meet this need.
Right.
You know,
I think most of us have that need.
Yeah.
Or at least feel the need, you know.
Yeah.
We might not know that that's the need we want.
Yeah. And it was through reading the Bible that I just remember reading it and literally words would jump off the page at me. Mm-hmm. Things would just absolutely become clear to me.
Right.
And it was in that period that I remember asking God above all things for wisdom. Didn't occur to me to ask for love. I was still probably have that anger running through me there, which is my default fleshly emotion. But I would listen to, I was in sales, and I got a lot of Bible teaching in the car. Like, the car is still my refuge. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't wait to get out of my house, you know, when I was younger, and into the car, because in the car I could control my environment.
Right.
So, which is just its own interesting thing with me and Frank, because Frank grew up in a pretty horrific situation. But for him, it was only safe at home.
Yeah.
Right. Just for the listeners, Frank is your husband.
Right. Yes. So, yeah. Yeah. So it's just kind of a dynamic that we figured out that, okay, I like to be in the car. I like to be home. We have to balance that out.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, the car is kind of my safe space too sometimes, but when I have my own room, which is what I have right now, I'm like treasuring it because I have it set up and I can just go in there and everything's where I left it.
Yeah.
I could just close the door and that's where I'll be.
So the car was your safe space. And so you would turn on audiobooks in there or something?
Is that what happened? There was no such thing as audiobooks.
That's right. Okay.
It would have been a cassette tape.
It would have been a cassette tape.
It's the 80s.
I actually listened to a lot of Bible programs.
Radio sermons?
Yeah, radio sermons, radio teachings.
Okay.
I think I just learned a lot about God that way. But above all things, what became the most important thing to me was to hear his voice. Mm-hmm. After you hear his voice, the way I heard it, that night I got born again, that's what I always am craving, right, is the voice of the Lord.
Yeah.
You know, how he talks about the voice of the Lord hovers over, you know, over the water. The Spirit of the Lord hovers over the water. I kind of equate the two.
Yeah.
You know.
Have you heard God audibly before? Like actual, like stuff you'd hear with your ears as opposed to like in your head? Kind of? Because
I don't know that I've ever tried to weed it out.
Right.
I think what happens, I've had multiple interesting, for lack of a better word, things happen. Like, I remember first time I stumbled across the verse that said, man looks on the outer appearance, but God looks at the heart. Mm-hmm. And I remember going, what does that mean? I really want to know what that means. What does that mean? And I felt like I didn't hear him say, I'm going to show you, as much as it was like, no, I'm going to show you. Right. And
just like something you knew all of a sudden inside.
It was something I wanted to know. And here's what happened. Now, I don't remember him saying this is what was going to happen, except that I'll show you what this means.
Right.
I'm like, okay. So the next thing I know, for probably a period of about a week, I'm able to hear what you're saying and what you're not saying. So an example would be, oh, I love that shirt you have on, but you're really thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe she's wearing that or shirt. I could hear them both. I could hear
like,
them both.
Like one inside your head or something, or like you just,
I just knew.
Somehow knew what they were thinking.
I just knew.
That's crazy.
It was it was crazy. And I'm telling you, after about a week, I'm like, okay, I get it. I'm done. I can't. But if I made eye contact with you and God wanted me to know, mm-hmm. I kind of knew what was in your head.
So that's like, just like in the movies then, you like, you heard what they were saying and then you could just like hear these.
Yeah, like, but here's what I think his point was, because it was the last person that I feel like he made his point. I think for the first few, it was like, Here's the outer appearance, mm-hmm. and here's the person's heart. Hmm. So just think about that for a minute, right. You know. But I feel like part of what he was trying to teach me was, back then I thought the greatest thing you could do was be financially successful. And I was in corporate sales at the time for United mm-hmm. Van Lines, and I remember we had this in Virginia, in Norfolk, they had this, their own little World Trade Center kind of thing. And I remember walking across the parking lot and I did feel the Holy Spirit. I felt a sense of pay attention. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, so this man walks out the door, a car has pulled up to pick him up. I don't remember if it was a limo or not, but it was a nice car. He's got a driver. The driver gets out, he opens the door. This guy's in a very nice, well-made trench coat. He's got a hat, the briefcase, everything that in my puny little brain would, be considered successful. He looked right. Totally successful. Like he didn't have a problem in the world. And as he's coming towards the car, I had crossed the street. I was going this way. And we made eye contact for just a moment. And in that moment, I just knew, I don't know that I heard, I just knew that he had marital issues. I knew he had a daughter that was pregnant. I knew he was just brokenhearted. He was brokenhearted, just heartbroken. And I had no business knowing any of that. I didn't want to know any of that. But you can just imagine how people perceived him.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But that's what was really going on. And yeah. And it was a great, great lesson for me mm-hmm. to learn that.
Wow.
That's cool.
Teaches you not to judge because you really don't know what you're looking at.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's going through something. Mm-hmm. So we can afford to be kind and compassionate. Yeah. Which is probably not the first two words people would use to describe me. But but I think my definition of love is a little interesting, though.
Yeah.
Because definitely. To me, if I love you, I'm going to hold you to the highest possible standard.
Yeah.
Why? How can I say that I love you and not with as much kindness and compassion as I can tell you the truth? Because mm-hmm. that is not love.
Right.
To me.
To just let them. It's not love. Just let them do whatever you mean.
It's not love to at least not show them they could do better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, or could go deeper, you know. I mean, don't you like your friend that goes, hey, man, we can do better than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, rather than the one that goes, it's fine. Nobody will know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, which one do you want in your corner?
Well, the love thing is you really want the best for that person, really.
Yes.
It's not this, it doesn't really matter to you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Call them higher.
Right.
But that's painful. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't say, that the verse totally escapes me now, but where he separates the marrow, mm-hmm. you know, from the bone, that's like extremely precise and it's painful.
Yeah.
No, it's painful. It's just painful, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
We used to have that poem. We used to call it the Dead Man's Club.
What?
Do you remember that? You don't remember that? No, you're probably too little.
Yeah.
I don't have it all memorized. It's a George MacDonald poem, and it goes something like, "Oh, well for him who breaks his dream with the blow that ends the strife, and waking knows the peace that flows around the pain of life. We are dead, my brothers, our bodies clasp, an armor our souls about. This hand the battle axe I grasp, and this my hammer stout." And there's another line in there that says something about, "And our life we throw to our people back to live with a further store. We leave it them that there be no lack in a land where we live no more." The point being, if you die to yourself, then the noise of life can't affect you. What affects a dead man? You know, what does he want? Mm-hmm. What does he crave?
Right.
What does he have to have? Well, nothing.
Right.
So if you live your life as if you're dead, which I wish I lived up to that poem. Don't misunderstand.
Yeah.
Then you're always, it's you that I want to have the life,
mm-hmm.
you know? So you give it to them.
Yeah.
Very other centered life rather than mm-hmm. selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. Yeah, I never. So you guys had a poem that was a club, you said? What?
They called it the dead Man's Club. And essentially it was just the brothers, you know, the brothers here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trying to remind each other why we're here.
Right.
You know, again, calling people higher or lower, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah.
Depending on lower. How you want to perceive that, yeah.
So you go through all this, you start going to church, you have just this turnaround where mm-hmm. you're using less drugs and less drinking, I guess, to the point where you're eventually off of it?
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
Okay.
Eventually it was, yeah.
Take years? How many years did that actually...
I don't think I tracked it that way. Okay. I think essentially association is pretty important. The people you hang around with is pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
The more I went to church, the more I was around people. That's not what we did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's not what we did for fun. That's not what we did for entertainment. You know, I was doing other things, you know, going to Bible studies and, you know, it's kind of like he filled my time with things that, you know, about him.
Yeah.
And that no longer consumed the lie that I had to have those.
Yep.
Anyway, from there, I was going to an Assemblies of God church. It's where I met my children's father,
mm-hmm.
Who was military. Probably the next big turn for me would have been right around my 30th birthday. I'd been a Christian for a while at that point. I had four children, a set of twins, and I guess in some ways you could say I had everything. I mean, I had need of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Was attending a very charismatic Bible study, prayer group of women.
Mm-hmm.
That called themselves the End Time Handmaidens, just how radical they were.
Wow.
And we used to fast once a week. But I wasn't happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't figure out why. And I just remember, I just kept going, "It really, is this all there is to following you? Is this like all there is? I mean, you're God, like
right.
the creator of the universe. And I'm over here living this mundane, I don't know what I was expecting, but I'm like, there's got to be more. Mm-hmm. There has to be more, you know? And at the time, the only more that I knew about was to be a missionary, you know? And I don't think there was anything in my husband who would want to do that. And so I didn't know what I was looking for, but I was looking for more of him. And so in order to be an end time handmaiden, you have to do a 21-day fast. But I was already felt like I needed to do something drastic to find peace or to be more fulfilled or mm-hmm. something. I'm a way overthinker. So just right. for the record on everything. So I probably yeah. do the same thing with God. And I just remember going, there's gotta be more. And mm-hmm. my 30th birthday was coming up and I remember going, well, if I wasted the first 30, I don't want to waste the next 30. Mm-hmm. So God, I got to figure this out. Hmm. And I took that fast. I did a liquid fast. I didn't like do nothing. Okay. So,
I was going to say.
I had too many kids to take care of to do a 21-day fast. And they were all very young. But I remember at that point going, I had been reading a book about the prophet Elijah. And, you know, kind of honed in on that whole expression, where's the God of Elijah? Mm-hmm. And in my mind, what I'm thinking when I say that is, here's a man on the earth, just like any other man, but he has a deep enough relationship with God that when he asks God to send down fire, he does. How does that happen? That's what I want to know. How does that happen? How do you get that kind of relationship with God? Mm-hmm. You know? That's what I wanted to know. That's still what I want to know, actually. That's probably the deepest burning question inside that I have is, what do I have to do to make that happen? Mm-hmm. You know? And, or does God just choose you and it happens? And what kind of obedience is required for that to happen?
Right.
But at the time, all I could think of is, yeah, I want that, you know, yeah. or I want, how does that, I really want to know. Mm-hmm. So in my fast, I was really just like, so where's the God of Elijah? Where's the God that does that? And that was the whole heart of it, the whole time, just my pursuit of wanting to be near him. Mm-hmm. And it was during that fast is when I conceived Elijah. Mm-hmm. And at that point, what was really big in the Christian circles was homeschooling and home birth and doing everything at home and all that. And I was well down that path. And so I really wanted to have this baby at home. Never mind that I had 3 C-sections and a set of twins and HHT. I'm not recommending this to anybody. Wow. But I really felt like I was supposed to do that. Yeah. And I thought, there's not a midwife in the world who's going to do that with me. So I heard there was a home birth seminar in Texas. Mm-hmm. And I found the midwife that had actually delivered Jonathan, because I already knew Aaron and Shabeth.
Yeah.
In Jacksonville. And, so I asked her if she wanted to be a midwife. She was like a midwife's assistant, really.
Okay.
Anyway, I told her I'd pay her way if she'd go to this home birth seminar with me. And it was there that I met Faith mm-hmm. and Havala. And I felt like God answered my mm-hmm. prayer. I found people that had more love for others, more love for God, more intimacy with God than anybody else I had ever met at the time. And I skipped a lot there, but, right. you know, I do feel like he answered the question, mm-hmm. you know, but it was a corporate answer.
And this was after you did that 21-day handmaiden fast. Interesting.
It was, I felt like it was his answer.
That's cool.
You know? And I went, here's people. I watch them. They pray. God answers. You know? And, I mean, again, I'm skipping a whole lot there, but, you know, but essentially when I was 30 was another big, big encounter for me.
So just for our listeners, you met these people and you eventually, I'm guessing, because we now live here in this community, you eventually were so sold out on their way of life that you ended up moving to the community in which they lived, or essentially that's what happened. Okay.
That's what happened. We would go on the weekends. They were in Florida at the time.
Yeah. The community was down in Florida.
Yeah. And we lived in Florida, but we were about 3 hours, I think, roughly apart.
Yeah.
And we started out going for birth meetings, which was once a month. And I was just like a moth to a flame, man. I'm like, you have something with God I do not have. That's all I knew.
Jealous.
And you were like, all I
knew
is
I was like, I want that. That's what I want. That kind, you know.
Right.
I just go, he loves us. He's our father. He wants closeness with us. That was the whole reason he created man, was for fellowship. You know, I think he wants the fellowship.
Right.
You know,
What's funny is one of the first times I felt like, well, not the first time, but one of the most prominent times I'd felt like God said something to me. It wasn't one of the, which is why I was asking. It wasn't very audible, but I just knew that's what he was saying. It definitely wasn't in his words, but it was my words. But it always seems to be very precise and not too many words. I was just really praying. I was actually on my knees for one of the first times I was praying on my knees. And I was just praying. It was very stressful. It was something I was very stressed about. And I was saying, Lord, Lord, start everything. You know, it was just Lord. And I felt like I had stopped. And God had just said, you know, call me Father instead. And I was like, okay. And so I've pretty much always prayed calling him Father from now on, you know?
Yeah, that's my tendency. I don't remember him ever telling me that. It's just...
Well, I'm not saying it's for everybody, I was like, I definitely felt like something he said to me to do.
It changes the dynamic,
right?
I think, of how we approach him, you know, we can, you know, we don't live in a time where you're calling people Lord. And so there's no genuine interactive picture of that for me. I mean, yeah, I get the gist of it. I know what it means. I understand the authority behind it, but Father has a whole,
right,
completely different connotation.
Right.
You know, it just seems more benevolent.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, that's a really good word, benevolent.
Well,
that pretty much sums up your story. That's amazing. So one question we usually always ask our interviewees.
Yes.
If we may. You go ahead.
Well, when, like, think of yourself, you know, back when you had, I guess when you had, after you had your miracle experience, right?
A portal opens and you're able to go back.
You're able to step through, I guess. What would you tell yourself now, like, about being a Christian and going down that path?
What would be the best advice to yourself?
Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding.
Yeah. That's good.
I had major trust issues. I still probably have less major trust issues. But trust him. Trust him. When I was in that rehab, the first thing they have you do, I guess, with all the new people is take you out somewhere and do like a team building kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted you to do a trust fall. I was like, I ain't doing it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it. There was like, no, you don't understand. We have to do it. I'm like, I'm not doing it. It's like, well, if you don't do it, you have to sit on the bus. Fine. I wouldn't sit on the bus the whole day. But God, in his mercy, totally redeemed that at a gathering in Bethel Springs. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember all the circumstances. I just remember it was an outdoor gathering. And he had me do a trust fall.
Hmm.
Intentionally.
Hmm.
And I did.
Wow.
Game changer.
That's awesome. That's interesting.
Yeah. He's done some pretty amazing things.
So that was like someone there at the gathering?
Yeah.
That ended up catching you?
But yeah.
Interesting.
Yep.
That's cool.
It was cool.
So that was kind of his way.
And I think it was several someones. I think the point being corporate, you know, I need to trust more than just one person.
Mm-hmm.
That was my tendency.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think if we wake up every day and you go, Lord, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You're grateful that you even woke up. I mean, I have this weird ritual. I go to bed at night and sometimes I just think about the homeless people. And I'm like, think of all the things I complained about that day. And it's like, no, Lord, thank you. I'm in a bed. I have a pillow. I have a blanket. I have heat. I have running water.
Right.
Half the world doesn't have this.
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing to complain about. It's just nice little reality check here.
Yeah.
You know, and in the morning, almost the same thing. But having a stroke, you start going, what's important?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just so grateful that I have no real deficiencies from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could have been half paralyzed.
Right.
I would not be happy.
No, you wouldn't.
It's like, it's too athletic for that. You know, thank you, Lord. Mm-hmm. But there's a book written by a man named Marcus Aurelius Anderson. The book is called The Gift of Adversity. And he was I don't know where he's at as far as being a Christian, but he was a military guy. Long story short, he woke up one day paralyzed. Wow. Right before he was about to deploy. Paralyzed.
How does that...
I'll let you read the book.
Okay.
I'll let you read the book. But he just talked about how it changed his life. And he fought and clawed his way back. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know he had been paralyzed. I didn't even know he'd written a book. I met him at a... I'm part of a business group called the Arte Syndicate. And I was at one of their live events.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sitting next to me. And I didn't know who he was from anybody until somebody at a break came up next to me and said, would you please sign your book for me? And I'm like, oh, he's like this famous TEDx speaker. I'm like, I don't know who this guy is. But I bought the book. So yeah. It's an awesome book. Just how it makes you go, so what are you tolerating now?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if you were paralyzed, if you woke up paralyzed tomorrow, what do you wish you would have done?
Right.
You know?
That's cool.
That you can't do now.
Yeah.
It's game changer as far as, you know, putting your life in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be your advice then to other people, young people, especially since you, as you said, they're your favorite.
They are my favorite.
What would you say to us? So we're going through this hormone time. We're going through this young, figuring out who we are, who everyone else is, you know, how the world works. What would be your advice in staying Christian and staying on that path to just everyone in general? Or maybe it's the same advice in that case.
Or
it's
even
okay.
Becoming Christian too.
Yeah.
You know?
Life is short. It's today's choices that matter.
Mm-hmm.
You may never figure all that stuff out. today, right now, what can you do to choose God? Mm-hmm. Just right now. Don't worry about forever. Don't even worry about tomorrow. You're that's an assumption you're going to get tomorrow.
Yeah.
This just is. So if you focus on today, make your plans, that's fine. I'm all for that. But be present. It's the little incremental choices that you make that determine who you become. Mm-hmm. Be okay. On the lookout. Trust the weird stuff. Trust the weird stuff. I mean, you know, just it's kind of like, it sounds like it's remember, you know, the book, The Dichotomy of Leadership, I'm sure. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think our Christian life is a lot like that too. If you get too anchored in the tangibles, you miss the spirit. Mm-hmm. And if you get so focused on the spirit, you miss the people that are right in front of you. Mm-hmm. So know what your bent is. Yeah. Know what your bent is and try to move to the middle, you know? And I know that you're loved with an everlasting love. Mm-hmm. Believe that with all your heart. We obey him because we love him, but he first loved us.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, and that way obedience does not become something you have to force yourself to do.
Right.
It's just a byproduct of your love.
That's good.
Yeah, that's really good. Oh, that feels like a finale to me. That that feels like a good one. Fine. A good way to end this.
Okay. Well, I want to say thank you very, very much for being able to chat with you guys.
No problem.
Well, it was truly our pleasure, honestly, because having someone like you on the podcast, like your stories, and I think about my life, and then I think about your life, and I'm just like, this is just not
right. What is going on? You haven't been around this long. I'm old.
That's true.
I'm an old gray-haired lady.
But yeah,
and that makes you magical.
No. Well, keep your eyes open. He will do for you.
Yeah.
What you ask for. You know, you want those things? Ask.
Ask and you shall receive.
Ask him for more. Yeah. You know, I'm no saint here. when I asked God for wisdom, I hadn't read, you know, remember what he said to Solomon. Oh, because you asked for wisdom, I'm going to give you long life and riches and I forget what else. And it's like, yeah, I'm
want in.
Right. I'll take it. You know, I'll take it. So, you know, I have my own. He knew. I'm not hiding that from him.
Yeah.
But I'm like, hey, if I'm going to ask, I'm going to ask for the total package.
Yep, totally. You know?
Ask for what you want and be grateful for what he gives you.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's good.
So, yeah,
that's cool.
Anyway, y'all are fun to talk to.
We try. I feel like I've said nothing this
Yeah, same.
Time.
I'm just like, how do I help here? But
I probably have
your stories.
Let you get a word in edgewise.
Well, your stories took the center stage, which is exactly how it's
that's
supposed
what
to
we
be.
Wanted.
Yeah, that's why we bring wanted. People on. Yeah.
God is good.
Amen. All the time.
All the time.
God is good. All right, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Yes, thank you.